This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Jack Brighton, Jason Croft at the controls this morning. A quick mention of tomorrow. In the first part of the show, Ann Tice will be here. She is a dermatologist at Carl Clinic, and we'll talk about skin, her area of practice. So any questions you may have, they'll be welcome in hour number one. Hour two, we'll be talking about nuclear power. A few weeks ago, well, maybe now, actually, maybe it's been a couple of months ago, we did a number of shows talking about energy from various perspectives. And on some of these programs, critical comments were made about nuclear power. And we wanted to have someone who was a proponent, someone who could speak from that perspective on the issue. It just took us a little while to find someone. We'll be doing that, though, tomorrow as we talk with Alan Walter, who is head of nuclear engineering at Texas A&M University. He'll be joining us by phone. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and I always encourage you to call. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about organized labor in the United States. Talk about what has been happening with organized labor in recent years, particularly in the 90s. And we'll take as our case study Decatur, Illinois, and talk about three strikes that occurred there. Strikes, and actually technically one, I suppose, was a lockout involving Bridgestone, Firestone, Caterpillar, and A.E. Staley. And our guest for the program this morning, Stephen Franklin. He is a labor writer for the Chicago Tribune and has been writing about labor for the Trib for nearly a decade. Before that, he worked for papers in Detroit, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Miami. And he's written a book based on some of the reporting on this issue that he did for the paper. It's recently out. The title of his book is Three Strikes, Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans. It's published by the Guilford Press. So as we talk with Stephen Franklin, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Franklin, hello.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I've talked with a lot of people across the country about the book I wrote, and I'm glad I could talk to a station like yours, because one of the reasons I wrote the book was really to tell a story about what happens in small heartland communities, and especially what happens to people in Decatur. And I'm sure there are people listening who are touched by what happened there, folks who have relatives. And I think what gets lost in all these stories and the recounting is the human effect. I was moved beyond belief in many cases of how deeply the scars are left in those people who are caught up in the situation.
Yeah.
And haven't forgotten them.
Well, certainly, and for the city of Decatur, it just seems to have been one bad news story after another. Of course, as people well know, I expect, one of the plants that you talk about here is been announced because of the problems Firestone has had with the Firestone tires. That plant's going to close. That's going to mean 1,500 people out of work. Just today, in fact, there was a story. The AP reported that another company, this is that has a foundry in Decatur, is talking about closing part of the plant. And that would be 200 people out of work, and apparently they already have a number of people laid off. So it just seems to be just bad news after bad news for the city.
Right. There's no question that Decatur has suffered markedly, and that's happened not just in the last few years, but in the last 40 years. It's lost a whole series of very important, very critical jobs. But I'd like to suggest that just as Decatur has suffered, so have a lot of Midwest blue-collar towns like Kankakee and Rockford, not so much Peoria, but places all throughout Iowa and Wisconsin, and especially Michigan, that made their living on these blue-collar jobs, and also the blue-collar jobs that paid better because they were union jobs, and that they were able to earn a higher wage. There's no question. And I'm glad you made the point also that the book is called Three Strikes, and there weren't three strikes. It's a metaphor, the baseball metaphor, about is this the last strike for organized labor? Can it get off its back and get on its feet again? And I talk about that, and I think it's a real question today that people should, not just folks who belong to unions, because there's so few nowadays. Only 9% of the nation's private workforce belongs to a union. That's a number that's been dropping for 5 decades. Overall, the figure is 13.5% of all workers. The reason for the difference is that many more workers in government services belong to unions. But when you have that number dropping so much, you have to wonder, will unions remain effective? And if you don't have unions, then who's going to speak for the people like myself and like you, those of us who draw our salary, and have interests that we can't represent? Hmm. Because these are critical questions, not just for someone who has a union card in their pocket.
The three situations at the three plants were a little bit different, although there were some things that were in common between all three. And I think that the main thing was here we had a situation where management decided that they were going to take a very tough, aggressive sort of stand when it came to negotiating new contracts. They wanted more control over wages. They looked like what they hoped was that they could actually, over time, decrease the percentage of the workforce that was union.
Well, I think it wasn't that many times that happens. Management or unions say they're going to take a tougher attitude. It wasn't just taking a tougher attitude. It was taking a new attitude. Mm. And I think in the case of Caterpillar, what they were saying there is we have to unlock ourselves from all the agreements of the past and also unlock ourselves from any binding agreements that linked us to other companies, because we're not a company that's bound to either the auto industry or any of our competitors. And what Caterpillar was saying at the beginning of the 1990s, we're a global competitor, we have to change things. And there was this very telling remark that, I don't know if many folks recall this, that Don Feitz, CEO of Caterpillar at the time, gave to the New York Times that basically said, and I'll paraphrase this, that American workers had been on an escalator carrying their wages upward, and they have to get off that escalator if they want to compete around the world. That was a signal that the company wanted to change things. In the case of A.E. Staley and Bridgestone Firestone, wages were a factor, but the real critical issue there, in both cases, the company said, the old agreements don't work. We have too many workers in the case of A.E. Staley. We have to outsource work. We have to improve productivity. But really, it was a workplace change. It was a lifestyle change. And the company said to the workers, many people will recall that we need you to go to continuous production. We need you to shift to 12-hour days instead of 8-hour days. And to folks who consider the job almost a right, a job that many people feel that they've worked very hard for. And I think a lot of people, let me just quickly say something, that I think a lot of people forget how much pride workers have in their work. And a lot of workers at AE Staley and Bridgestone Firestone said, I'm proud of my job, and I like the work I'm doing, but I can't work 12 hours for 3 days or 4 days a week. It's tiring, and if I'm a single parent or a single husband, how am I going to get home and take care of my kids? And I think it was also just the notion that my life is changing. I don't know how I can work, people were saying, with no weekends. Because as you know, the shift as you go to a continuous production, what you find is that there's no Saturdays and Sundays anymore. You work 3 days on, 2 days off, 3 days on, 4 days on, 2 days off, and the process continually flows. Mm. The thing that also struck me, that this is not a situation that why I thought this is important, and I wanted to make this message to a lot of workers, is that this is a process that's changing throughout the country. Increasingly, you see factories, utilities, healthcare facilities going to a 12-hour day. As many nurses would tell you, after 12 hours on the job, and sometimes 13 if it's a very difficult day, there's a syndrome of, I can't get home. I'm tired, I haven't had a drive, and I'm exhausted. Oftentimes, you find that industrial accidents happen at the end of the shift, when workers are putting in long shifts. It makes a lot of sense, I think, to run a power plant if you're sitting in a nice, quiet room and hitting a button. That's all you do. But if you're working for 11 to 12 hours on your feet, cutting rubber, handing out syringes, taking care of people in a very acute, difficult situation, that's exhausting. And I think that's the issue that struck me. It's the shift of time and a greater issue that some people call it time theft. American workers today work more as far as hours than any of our colleagues in the 11 major industrial countries. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. I think that's come about for a number of reasons, but A lot of that has been the loss of control over the workplace, the need to work harder, and the fear that if you don't work harder, you can't get the job done. These are issues that not just affect someone who makes a tractor in Decatur, but someone who teaches in school or works in a hospital or who does a job where you're asked to do more than maybe you've done in the past.
Maybe real quick here, I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Stephen Franklin. He's a labor writer for the Chicago Tribune and has written a book that takes a look at three industrial actions. The title of the book is Three Strikes, Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans, published by the Guilford Press. And it's set in Decatur and takes a look at what happened in three places with Caterpillar, with Bridgestone Firestone, and with A.E. Staley in the 90s. And not only what the book looks at, not only what that meant for Decatur, but in a larger sense, what that means for working people in America. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. It seems that one important part of the story is, and when you look at what changed and how it was that these workers were put in such a difficult position, one of the things that it seemed to change was management's increasing willingness to permanently replace striking workers, so that people who were on strike were looking at the possibility that they could lose their jobs, and
right,
that put them in a position where they felt ultimately they had to accept what the company was offering.
Right, right. I think that was a case that a Bridgestone Firestone company took, and it was the single largest replacement by a private company that had taken place. As you know, and in the United States, companies have had the right since the late 1930s to replace workers. But this was not an action that most companies had invoked because they realized it's such a toxic action, such a powerful tool. It's on such a shiver down workers' backs. And it really was given a great prompt when President Reagan in the early 1980s replaced the striking air traffic controllers. So the great shock for a lot of the Bridgestone Firestone workers was that after 2-3 months of the strike, when the company decided that there was no progress, things are going nowhere, and they had the right, and they do, to replace workers. A lot of people couldn't believe that this is the job that they had spent their lives on, they had given great pride to. The thing that really, there are two things that struck me, and I'd love to hear what people's reaction to that, is that I was stunned by the lack of support you found in a lot of places around Decatur. And I'm talking about the folks across the picket lines, and also the sense I got from talking to people at the time that, oh, these folks are selfish. Look at the wages they're getting, $18 an hour. How much more do they want? So they have to work a little harder. They have to change their hours. And also the sense that they're radical. All this creating barriers, the entrance to Decatur and calling it a war zone. I heard a lot of anger toward these workers, and that surprised me. I had always gone along with the mythology, but in smaller communities, there's a sense of cohesion, there's a sense of support. Surely not if you're management and hourly, there's a division. But still, there's a sense of propriety, but let's stand behind people. I didn't see that in this case. I wondered why that took place. Mm. And I think my suspicion that this is part of the strange personality we have as Americans is that we fiercely believe in our individuality, and that when others are going through a problem, we say, well, that's their problem, I can't relate to it. And the second thing is we don't have a lot of a sense of class solidarity. Someone who's making $15 an hour but the same background as I have, and I'm making $7 working at a warehouse, I look at them and I say, heck, if I can get that job, I'll take it.
Yeah.
That's what struck me. I thought that was important. But that's part, that underlying force explains a lot of the weaknesses of unions or weaknesses of organizations.
I have a caller here, and we have somebody calling from a car phone, so we want to try to get right to them, and we'll bring them into the conversation. So we'll do that right here on line number one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
My question was, did the employers know how much, or do you have any indication, I guess, they would know how much the 12-hour shift would hang their workers, I guess, I can't do anything else but work now, really. I know a lot of these guys, and it seems to me like you could have run 24-hour production with 8-hour shifts just fine.
Well, what you found starting with the Michelin Company when they first came to the United States is that they were the ones who introduced the 12-hour shifts at tire factories, and what the difference between an 8-hour and 12-hour shift is that you don't have the you have fewer changes of workforce. You don't have to rely upon the maintenance crews that come in at night. And also the other thing is that you're rolling constantly. You don't have to stop on once you move to that program, because work is put in a 3-day, then it's not, or a 4-day, depending upon how much time they do it. Then you roll right through the weekend. You don't have to pay weekend pay. You don't have to pay some cases a night differential. For the factory, this is money saving, far more efficient. And when I approached Lisa Bridgenell Firestone, their argument was that it's not more dangerous. They haven't had problems. There is a strong feeling out there among American manufacturers that 12-hour shifts aren't that dangerous. At worst, you find backaches and bad feet problems. The reverse is true with the physicians who look at the occupational problems, especially if you have to go, if you work, let's say, a month of days and a month of nights. A lot of people can't adjust to that. A lot of people can't reset their time clocks. I think that was a problem. And the other problem that you find is that I think in the case of East Valley, what they were looking at is that they want to take away the union's control of who works days and who works nights. This is basically a challenge to seniority. And they're saying, we don't want only the older workers on the job in the days. We want some of the younger workers moving around. And that was a direct challenge to the union's control.
Okay, thank you.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call. And other calls are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just to go back to the point you made before we talked to the caller, because I think it's very important. We talked about what things changed and why the union was in such a difficult position. And one thing, as we mentioned, was the increasing willingness of management to permanently replace workers. But the other thing that just seems so striking is just what you point to, that apparently the willingness of people to cross a picket line, and not just somebody who was not a union member. Right. There were actually union members who were crossing
the picket line. Right. Well, in the case of the rubber workers, for example, you had over 300 workers across that, their own union's picket line, and including the former president of the local. I talked to some of the... not a lot, because I found it very difficult to talk to the folks who crossed the lines. They were angry, they were embarrassed, they were fearful. Some of their lives have been threatened, and I'm also curious. I'd love to hear what if someone can talk about that. What the reaction I got was they didn't trust the union. If they were a younger worker and they'd been laid off, and as you recall, throughout the 70s and 80s, a lot of jobs were wiped out in Illinois. And so they feared if they didn't take an action now, then they wouldn't protect themselves. Once they got across the picket line, then they couldn't go back. They were terrified. I wonder, how people were able to work this through. My impression is that many of the families that were divided, many of the neighbors, many of the communities have not healed those wounds. As folks across the picket lines have not gone back and made friends and restored relationships, and families that have been divided still live that way. I think it's a tremendously high price to pay.
Let's talk with someone else. Here we have a caller in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Annie.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I'm appreciating your show. Not just the prior comment, but just before that, I think it really points out the personal toll that this does to workers. Living in Champaign, I'm trying to remember back to that time. It seemed like all we knew was what we read in the paper, and you didn't get all the feeling of what was happening to people personally. But I was on a church conference board at the time, and we had a woman come from one of the churches in Decatur and to share her story and her concern, and they had both worked for Staley. As I remember, he had over 20 years seniority. She had something like somewhere between 15 to 17 years. I think their children at the time were teenagers. And she talked to us, and it really enlightened us about what was happening there. She talked about the 12-hour shifts that your guest has referred to. And I remember, you know, kind of putting myself in her shoes. I remember her telling that it looked like it was just an attempt to break the union, because they put her on one 12-hour shift, her husband on the opposite 12-hour shift. So they literally were, and they were working often 7 days a week, and they literally were not seeing each other except coming and going. And I remember the other example that she talked about. Her husband had for many years coached some sort of sports for children in the community, and they not only had the 12-hour shift, but they were on one shift so many weeks, and I can't remember how long, and then they would shift them to something else. So he never knew really far enough ahead to be able to commit himself now to these coaching kinds of things. And so the personal toll it took on that family, and then, but they remained loyal to the company, kept on working, and then went to work one morning. She went to work the one morning and found that she was locked out. Here we were thinking of it as, you know, these striking workers, but in reality they had been locked out of that particular company. But I just remember that, and he talked about not having support, not living in Decatur. I'm not really sure, but I know within our own church we were wanting to do at annual conference some resolutions around the issue. And it divided. I remember the discussion, because there were people in our churches that were in management, and there were those in labor, and so a lot of people didn't want to touch it.
Well, let me kind of
say that they would offend one or the other.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could just say, why were people distancing themselves? Why wasn't there a willingness to accept what the workers were saying? I mean,
well, I was willing. I was really touched, and my sympathies lie with labor. I grew up in Pennsylvania. My father was a factory worker and a steel worker, and there were unions there, and I think the unions were stronger there than they are here. I don't know. I was, you know, willing to, you know, do something. Although there were people in Decatur, I know a minister who's retired now who walked those lines with, you know, with the people who were out on strike or who were locked out. And actually, I think he was arrested at one point for being out there.
Are you talking about Father Mangan?
No, this was a Methodist minister.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if he'd want me to say his name or not. He probably doesn't care. It was Bob Weidrich.
Uh-huh, right. And he was one of the early leaders of the... I thought that was a fascinating action also in that indicator, and what you've seen across the country also,
right,
is that the clergy has come closer to the unions in many cases, representing...
Well, he walked with many of the people in his congregation, and he, I think, was probably the one who, you know, called it to our attention. The conference board I was serving on was a social issues board.
Right. There was you talk about the impact on people's lives. Father Mangan, who's quite sick right now, by the way, if anyone knows him.
Oh, okay, yeah, and I think I might have met him.
And was quite he was drawn into it. He didn't have much of a history in labor actions anyway, but he told me the story of one of the daily workers who was injured in an accident, and he was called to the hospital in Decatur to perform the last rites. And as the man was losing his life, his wife leaned forward and said, "Well, at least you won't have to go back to the factory now."
Mm-hmm.
A stunning, you know, stunning explanation of the pain that people go through. He told me another story. Another time he was attending a funeral, and a worker came up to him and said, "Father, you know, I was one of the staley workers, and I never went back, and I'm working here in the cemetery, and my son crossed the picket line. Can you believe that?" I don't know. What strikes me is I don't know if people realize the intense emotional force that takes place for the average person caught up in these disputes. And I wonder whether union officials do, and
whether companies who say we're going to take these tough actions really realize that the powers of one of the Caterpillar officials, not in Decatur, but in Denver, when the union decided to go back largely under the company's terms because they couldn't work a deal out and there was no resolution, this is close to the end of the 6.5 years, felt that he had led his workers the wrong way and that he couldn't stand up to the company more. He went home from Detroit and put the car on in his garage and took his life.
Yeah.
I know several people who one of the workers I talked about in the Bristol Firestone worker, his wife died of a heart attack in the middle of during the dispute. The powerful force. Thing that also that struck me, and I like to hear people talk about that, is that a lot of men went through a trauma here that was a repeat of what they went through in Vietnam. And that was, I discovered this one day, I was at a picket post, and the man was there, and we started talking, and he said, I went to Vietnam out of high school, and I came back, and nobody welcomed me. I thought I had made a big mistake, and I went through work here, and I got laid off. I lost money, came back, but I'm still hanging on to my job, and now I feel like I made a mistake again. I mean, I thought I was doing the right thing. I thought I was standing up for America, and look around me, there isn't a big support. I think a lot of folks who work in the factories, men who have this generational history, really felt defeated, and they couldn't talk about it, and that became a problem because their wives couldn't understand it, and this spread throughout the families.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I hope you'll forgive me because we're
I'm just listening now. I hear pain that he's in, and I share that.
Yeah.
And I don't have anything else to come.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your call, and I have somebody else here we'll get right to in just a moment. And for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here, I do want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Stephen Franklin. He writes for the Chicago Tribune, writes about labor, and has been doing that for almost 10 years now. He's authored a book that explores what happened to Decatur in these three situations that we've touched on in the 90s at Bridgestone Firestone, at A.E. Staley, and at Caterpillar. And his book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Three Strikes, Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans. It's published by the Guilford Press, and which he makes this argument that what happened in Decatur was not just significant for Decatur, certainly it was, but not that it had a significance greater than that, and in fact that it was sort of writ small what was happening in the economy and with organized labor all over the United States. So it's a very well-written book. You might seek it out, take a look at it. Questions, of course, are welcome to the 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We have someone else to talk with. Let's do that. This is also Champaign. It's line number 2. Hello?
Yes. I'd just like to ask Mr. Franklin to comment on two what I consider recent developments. And the first is when you speak of unions' successes, they're always spoken of wistfully as something that happened long ago. And I'm wondering if part of the reason for that might be that just as you can't tell Republicans from Democrats any longer, you can't tell union from management. They seem to have chummed up to the extent that they don't advocate as strongly as they might for the worker. And the second is, do you notice a phenomenon whereby unions seem to be more focused on organizing, but once they've collected their membership, don't seem to do much advocacy either? I'll hang up. Thank you.
No, I think you've raised two very good and very important questions. And let me go over the first one, is that, and it's confusing. I think in the 1980s, unions were faced with a terrific problem. And once again, we're largely talking about unions where there's job loss, where the jobs are threatened. And management came to them and said, we have to cooperate. So you had this thing called employee participation programs, employee cooperation. And in many cases, they said, look, there are 200 rules on this contract. We don't need that many rules. Let's wipe them out. A lot of unions were encouraged because it seemed to open the door to more control. Some unions, and in the case of Caterpillar, for example, there was hesitancy, but the company made such a strong appeal, they went forward and embraced the agreement. The difficulty is that Some of these agreements are window dressing. Companies don't live up to them. They don't follow them through. Unfortunately, what happened in the 80s became a disaster for Genius, because as soon as the economy began to roll through problems in the 90s, companies turned around and said, you know, we made this agreement, we had this cooperation, we opened up books to you. Sorry, folks, the economy's bad, you have to leave your jobs right now. Or they backtracked, and suddenly unions felt abandoned. So, I think the effort to cooperate was a reasonable effort, and the UAW was one of the unions, having a long history of head-to-head conflict with the automakers, that embraced this, and the Saturn plant was a great example. The problem with these employee cooperation programs is that the company really didn't sign on 100%, and as soon as push came to shove, in all of these cases, in Decatur, in Bridgestone, Firestone, Caterpillar, and to some degree in the East Daly, I apologize saying all the cases, the company had reached out to the workers and said, let's cooperate. When the troubles came by, they wiped it out. So this explains a lot of the distrust. And then your second question also is very important, and that raises, a real question about what unions intend, which, unions are, since the mid-1990s, as a result of some of the drive from the AFL-CIO, the umbrella organization for the nation's 68 unions, are spending more money on organizing. Not all. And the reason they're doing that is because they want to stay alive. Today, if unions organize at the current pace, then the number will drop even more markedly. They have to organize three times what they do. The problem is that once they get a contract, once they get workers organized, they run into some marked difficulties in getting a first contract. I think only once, if I'm correct, less than 40% of unions that get win the right to represent workers win a contract the first time around. In other words, the company and the union can't reach an agreement and sign contract. The second problem is that a lot of unions are aiming all over the ballpark, and they're wildly scattering their efforts. So you find the Teamsters organizing in healthcare and police services, and there's a race. At least six or seven unions are trying to sign up nurses. Unions are running after college graduate assistants, and part of the difficulty with this, I compliment them being aggressive, but when you have workers who join a union and the union doesn't have much experience in that area, you wonder what kind of services can they provide to them. There is a thinking amongst a number of AFL-CIO unions that unions should go back to the days when folks who worked in one line of industry belonged to that union. SCIU is a strong believer in this, and their feeling is they want to be the healthcare union. And they say, let's cover health care, let the steel workers and the auto workers do their things. Other unions don't want to agree to that. And that raises the question, if I'm suddenly representing a bunch of nurses, however, I happen to be an official with the United Mine Workers Union, I know my industry, I may not be the best person to represent those people, so that's another reason why you have problems. Those are serious questions. Organizing is up, but the question is, can unions perform? I think the biggest disappointment among workers is that the union doesn't provide its workers hope to get. And oftentimes, what workers want is not a better pay raise, but simply more justice, more respect on the job. And that's a difficult thing to win always.
We are coming into about our last 10 minutes, and we're going to continue, of course, to talk with our guest, Stephen Franklin. He writes for the Chicago Tribune. Questions are welcome. You like to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller up in the northern part of Illinois on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in the perception by the general public, because, as I recall, the Teamsters, there were always news programs about the Teamsters were sleeping on the job and the union would protect them, or there was corruption and that type of thing. And then you had upwardly mobile, like bright people who were in a union, but they wanted their kids to have a job that wasn't dirty, that, would make more money. So some of the brightest people were leaving, their children were leaving unions, going to college, that type of thing. And it's just also setting different unions, different people against each other, where the airline mechanics couldn't count on the pilots' union to help them. And then when the pilots would strike, the maintenance people would say, well, why bother? And I think there's no common interest in helping out each other, as you mentioned before. And I don't know how to build that. You know, how can you build that?
Well, I think, you know, it's once again, I appreciate your question because it's very pertinent. And the point is that some unions don't cooperate. And they say, I'm sorry, I'm going my own path. And recently you saw the Carpenters Union pull out of the AFL-CIO saying, oh, sorry, guys, we have our own goals. When that takes place, then all unions are diminished. And true, there have been disputes where, and Decatur was a good example. The production workers, all three facilities went on strike, but the building trades workers didn't stand behind them. And they basically said, years ago, you didn't respect our picket lines, so we're not going to help you guys either. That's a real problem. But let me get back to the other issue, and I think that's a problem with Americans too, and I'm baffled by it, and that is, yes, there are corrupt unions, and they continue today. Yes, there are lazy unions, there are stupid unions, there are unions that are undemocratic. But I think the basic notion is, don't people want representation? If you work in a hotel and you make beds and you earn $6 an hour, just above the minimum wage, don't you think you want a union to represent you and make sure that, A, you get a better pay raise, and B, that there's no sexual harassment on the job? I don't understand why Americans feel so uncomfortable with unions.
Well, I think if you think that you or your children will eventually be in management, that you'll make more money and it's worth it, and I don't know what's going to happen now with, you know, a lot of stockbrokers and a lot of other people being out of work, what their thought process is going to be. But companies seem to be able to manipulate the media and, you know, blame, they used to blame the blacks, then they used to blame immigrants. And I don't know if there's going to be an endless, you know, it's not your fault, it's, well, the union's fault. And until somebody says, you know, I won't buy this product unless it's made in America, or, you know, join together and form a union, you know, I really think it's going to be very, very difficult.
I mean, let me make the other point, that I don't think it's only a union that people need. I think basically, since unions represent such a small part of the workforce, it's a general need for association. If you happen to be school social workers, who are not part of a union, or say school psychologists or workers who have a common need. Doctors are a good example. You see doctors organizing today, and they're very fearful about getting involved in unions because they don't want to strike. They don't want to be committed to that. But they see their industry under tremendous pressure to a role where they think are their rights and benefits. I think people are yearning for some situation that says we have to band together. And that's an issue. So I see there is a need out there for representation, whether it's unions or not. That's not clear. And if unions raise the situation, they'll win.
Do I have time for one more?
If you can be quick.
Okay. The number of union workers who voted for Reagan and then didn't realize that the people he appointed who would utterly destroy, you know, a lot of their rights. And until you have a leader like Reagan, but on the opposite side, because Reagan was saying, oh, I'm patriotic, you know, I want a big defense, and that'll mean jobs for you, even though he never served in World War II, you know, unless there's a movement like that. Do you agree?
I think one of the big problems is that there's not a voice that you hear from the Democrats, who would be the opposition, that says clearly this is where workers' interests are, and we mean workers, we mean the folks who pick grapes and the folks who also fly planes. There's not a Walter Reuther today. That's a problem. That's a real lack.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks. Oh, how much, Ms. Franklin, how much do you think, you know, the caller was making reference to perceptions that people have of labor, which has to come from the way that the news media cover labor.
Uh-huh.
And certainly there's plenty of coverage of labor corruption. Now, I don't know, maybe one might say, well, it's not the job of the news media to remind us of anything positive that organized labor uh-huh. has done. But, you know, what I wonder what you think about the role that news media coverage of labor plays in general perceptions of organized labor.
Let me just say, saying one thing. There was a news, you know, the Associated Press did a survey came out yesterday, and they said by 2-1 Americans support unions, and this is a marked increase over the last 2 decades. So clearly there is a shift, you know, whether people support unions and then say, okay, it's right to go ahead with it. There is that change. And I think the second point is oftentimes the media does report problems. There are very few people nowadays like myself who cover the news media. Cover labor. Mm. And as a consequence, what you often hear are stories about problems, about strikes, stories about corruption. And there are some unions that do have problems with that. The news tends to be negative. There's a reverse, however. There is, you know, I increasingly see stories about how workers are getting benefits provided to them once they join unions or they come together. And one of these happens to be the role of immigrants in this country. What you've seen in the last few months is a marked U-turn on the view of unions saying we now have to embrace undocumented workers, and they deserve rights, and they deserve to be treated well. And at the same time, in Los Angeles, in New York, and Chicago, where you have large numbers of Latino and Eastern European immigrants, they're bringing a new energy back to these unions. So there are, it's a very mixed message.
Hmm. Well, let's talk again with some more folks here. We'll go to Champaign County, line number 2. Hello.
Hi, good morning. So much to cover, but I was moved to call. Your media question's really important, I think, because I think there was a study that showed that as far from being liberal, most press people are very bad on economic issues, and I think that unions are included in that. There's a lot of lack of reporting of just even the bad, it seems to me. The Carpenters Union just pulled out of the AFL-CIO in the last couple of months, and I wouldn't know that except I know some people in the union, so I don't think that was covered very well. The fellow that Bush is intending to elevate to the chair of the NLRB is at least as egregious as any of his appointees, and there's very little. I'm not saying that the other appointees shouldn't have been made a big deal of, but they. This guy is incredibly bad, and there's very little discussion of it. I don't know. Just the general thing is that there are very few people on the labor beat anymore.
Well, I'm just curious. How do you follow news? I mean, do you read newspapers? I mean, or do you rely solely on television?
No, they're probably email lists are uh-huh. most important for me offhand. At least on this issue, certainly. There are many people from this community that went over to these massive rallies in Decatur to try to bring it back to that, which we're hooking it on. The 12-hour shifts, 3 days on, 3 days off, is just so pernicious. I mean, it is incredible. I know you. I wasn't able to hear all of your. I know you covered that a little bit, but it's so abusive to people. I mean, talk about family values. It's ridiculous. This is corrosive. It's back to the worst days of the sootiest part of the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Anyway, I'll hang up and let the last person get on. Thanks.
Okay, well, let's go again to another Champaign person. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, good.
I have a question. What was you had a woman caller that had made mention of Reagan. What was her point?
That perhaps he made an attempt to reach out in his campaign to working people, and yet when he was elected, took a strong anti-labor stance, exemplified by his firing of the Patco workers, I guess.
Okay, that's what I thought. The one question that I did want to ask, though, is where do businesses draw the line with labor?
I think it's a difficult question to answer. I think, generally speaking, most corporate America does not feel comfortable with labor unions. They would prefer not to have a union on the spot. That's not true for every case, but if you look at the basic attitudes of most companies, that a union-free job site is the preferred one.
Mm-hmm. I think that primarily that the public opinion, no matter what position a business takes, if they don't want to go along with what a union thinks, then the American population just tends to they hate that. I mean, would you agree with that?
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think most folks want unions or think unions have a role in this country?
I honestly wouldn't know. I know my own personal beliefs on it. I think that there's a lot of gray area involved. I mean, on one hand, you've got businesses that have a tendency to exploit, and then after, you know, a period of time, the unions do the same thing, you know, and they just, on both sides, you've got a lot of people that are trying to take advantage of the situations that they're in.
Uh-huh. Well, let's say we have no unions. Do you think people can get by on the job without anyone speaking on behalf of them?
No.
Well, we're almost in that case right now. Only 9% of, less than 1 out of 10 workers who works for a company, not for the government, has a union representation. You know, it would seem to me that people are willing to put up with this.
Yeah, I would agree with. I would agree that that's probably true. I think that the big problem that we have is I think we have a primarily lazy workforce.
Uh-huh. Lazy in what aspect? Because I think most workers work very hard. I think I don't go by the idea that workers are lazy and that they don't do their job, because I've gone to many factories and I'm astounded how hard they work. I've been to many offices and the long hours. I think workers maybe are apathetic. My argument also is that workers as Americans, we're unusual people. Instead of taking to the picket lines or going down to the boss's office, we take Pepto-Bismol. We swallow our problems. We get laid off and we move on, and we don't look around for what we could do. Maybe that's the problem. I mean, once again, I was astounded by what took place in Decatur, because I think a lot of the heartland values that you find in Decatur and Champaign-Urbana and all throughout the Midwest were challenged. And a lot of people didn't stand up and say, yeah, we agree, we're on your side with that.
How do you think that over time, though? I think one of the things that we're unfortunately almost out of time, we've talked about how there is this decreasing percentage of the labor force that is unionized, and now there would have been a time when in everybody's family, if they weren't a union member, they would probably have a family member who was. They had a father who was a union member, a grandfather who was a union member, maybe both. Now it seems that there are fewer and fewer people who they have no connection whatsoever. They're not in a union. They've never been. Their neighbors aren't. Their parents weren't. Is that something you think is likely to continue?
Well, you know, I'm not a prophet, but I see a lot of problems for unions. I see them running real hard, but almost staying in place. But let me just step back a second. I think, Labor Day should really be called Work Day. And I think when people think about what's happening to unions, and if you don't belong to a union, you have to think about, am I getting ahead of my job? Am I being treated with respect? Because I'm a woman, am I stuck in my job? Because I happen to be Latino, or because I'm the first African American in this office, am I getting the promotions I need? These are all common issues. If I'm 55 years old and the company has just wiped out my pension and said, "Sorry, Steve, you don't have a pension anymore," those are all workplace issues that unions. The problem is that people differentiate between a union that is an insurance agent that provides issues. We all have workplace concerns, and so I'm concerned that people, if you bury those issues and say, oh, unions only care about them, then who deals with all these other questions?
Yeah. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I really appreciate you giving us some of your time to talk today.
I can't thank you enough.
Our guest, Stephen Franklin. He writes about labor issues for the Chicago Tribune. And if you're interested in looking at the book that we've talked about, once again, the title of the book is Three Strikes: Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans. And his book is published by the Guilford Press.